Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick, and I'm here with Pastors Bob Thune and Dusty White of Cormdale Church and Pastor Chris Hummelman of First City Church in Bellevue, Nebraska. Every Wednesday, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life, and today we're talking about the Reformation.
Dusty's driving the police car today, guys.
Just in case.
Dusty's an Omaha police chaplain, and occasionally he gets to drive a car with lights. So today's that day.
Actually drive the car with the lights on. You can turn on the lights.
For chaplains too?
Yeah, man. You should give it a shot.
Sweet. Maybe I will.
So we're here with Chaplain Dusty and the rest of us who are just pastors.
I don't get a cool car being a pastor.
Hey, we want to tell a little bit of the history of the Reformation. Here's what I've noticed. You know, it's obviously the 500th anniversary of the beginning of the Reformation this year. And to understand the Reformation and why it was so sort of world-changing, you got to understand some of the history to it. And it's a fascinating story. This time, this year, and every year, I tend to get in little debates with Roman Catholic friends who want to argue about what the Reformation was. And sometimes Christians, evangelical-ish people, have a real thin view of what the Reformation is. So that'd be fun to just tell the story, tell the history of it a little bit. So let's go back to the year 1517, when Martin Luther posted his 95 Theses to the door of Castle Church in Wittenberg. And let's realize that actually the Reformation began almost 100 years before that, if not more. So though Luther was sort of you could call him the bull in the China shop that sort of knocked everything over and got everything sort of riled up, the seeds of Reformation had been going for some time in the Catholic Church. It's hard to overestimate the corruption that was present in the medieval church. This was the Middle Ages. The papacy was quite corrupt, and there were some practices that were just, you know, if they were taking place today, everybody would be in an outcry about them. For instance, the sale of church offices. So you can be a bishop if you have a lot of money, you can buy your way into having a church office, which of course at that time in a world that's largely defined by church lines, being a bishop is a place of high authority and honor. And so the selling of church offices, which is called simony, the selling of indulgences, which we talked about in a sermon a few weeks ago. An indulgence is a release from purgatory and that the Pope was purportedly able to grant. And the scandal of the selling of I had this dialogue with a guy this week who is Roman Catholic and was offended that I had said the church was, you know, selling indulgences, because he said, well, that might have been going on, but that, you know, that wasn't the official church's position. Well, the scandal behind that is Pope Leo X was getting half the cut of all indulgences, all money made off the selling of indulgences. So it very much was, I mean, you know, most Roman Catholics will say, well, yeah, but the church after that decried that. Yeah, sure. But in the moment, it was the highest leader in the church who was complicit in that whole arrangement. So there was a lot going on politically and culturally at the time of the Reformation, and there were seeds of Reformation. There were voices across Europe sort of standing up and crying foul for a long time. But I want to dial back the clock to the year 1453, because there were two significant things that happened in 1453. One was the fall of Constantinople to the Turks, and the second was the invention of the printing press. Actually, Gutenberg, the printing press was invented sometime between 1447 and 1455. Gutenberg was sort of playing with movable type throughout those years. The Gutenberg Bible was printed in 1455, so that's sort of a good marker for, okay, now we have the printing press. But so let's think about Constantinople. Let me just tell you a little bit about the city. The Emperor Constantine built the city of Constantinople, which is in modern-day Turkey, in the 300s, and he built it as sort of another capital. So there was Rome, the capital of the Western Roman Empire, and then Constantine built Constantinople as like a second capital, sort of like a summer home, sort of like how people go to Miami in the winter. It was like Constantine's second capital. And Constantinople became a very powerful city, and in that city was a large deposit of artifacts from the early church period. So you think about all the heritage of Greek culture. If you think about the difference between the Western and Eastern Roman Empire, the Western Empire is mostly Latin-speaking, And that's where we get, for instance, Jerome's translation of the Vulgate, which was translated in the 4th century, that was in Latin, that was done in the Western Roman Empire. Constantinople carried forward the heritage of Greek culture. So, of course, the Romans took over sort of Greek culture, but all the Greek-speaking works and Greek art sort of made its way to Constantinople. And so in Constantinople were treasures going all the way back to Greek culture. The Greek poets and Greek art, Greek literature, these things were sort of gathered in Constantinople. So when the Turks conquered Constantinople in 1453, what happened was a bunch of influential people sort of smuggled many of these literary works out of Constantinople and took them to safety in places like Rome or places like Europe, places like Switzerland. And so basically what happened is at the same time that the printing press was invented, you had this influx of classic works from the Greek and Roman period that were now available to scholars to study. So think about, you're a scholar at the University of Paris. It's the Middle Ages. You're basically trying to survive the plague and, you know, make sure that life is manageable. And all of a sudden, these people from Constantinople who are fleeing, these refugees, are bringing with them original copies of Homer and of the New Testament and of the works of Josephus, and all these old works are now becoming sort of plentiful within Europe. And so there's this whole movement that arises that we now know as humanism, but it's basically just a return to sort of the classical Greek and Roman culture. Now that these cultural things are coming in, you know, like, well, let's learn Greek so we can translate these works and figure out what these authors were saying. And there's this massive surge of interest in scholarship. Here's why that's important for the Reformation. Because for hundreds and hundreds of years, it was sort of like whatever the Pope in Rome said was what the church said, and that's just what people did. Because that was just sort of, the emphasis was very much on hierarchy and on heritage. Once you have original, you know, so let's say, you know, the Pope's been telling us for hundreds of years that purgatory exists and how we're supposed to, deal with the demands of purgatory, whether that's through buying indulgences or masses for the dead or blah, 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 right? There's all these doctrines that have been formed by the Roman Catholic Church. Well, now we have second century manuscripts of the New Testament coming in, and we're feverishly translating them and realizing, I don't see anything in these New Testament manuscripts about this. So there's sort of this resurgence of learning that goes back to the early Greek and Roman era, and at the same time, just a multitude of interest in the Bible, in classic works, in the works of ancient history. And so all of this sort of flashes at the same time. So if you think about 1453 to 1517, that's a period of about 60 or 70 years. You've got the printing press. You've got this influx of these classical texts. You've got these longings for Reformation, these people who have been standing up and saying, hey, this indulgence thing doesn't seem quite like a good thing. And so all of this conflagration is happening at the same time. Then you have Luther, who, by all accounts, is a very bombastic person, and he just decides, I'm going to stand up and call for debate. And so in 1517, he puts forward the 95 Theses, which are this call for debate about indulgences, basically. And this, what happens is someone takes the 95 Theses off the door of the church, prints 300,000 copies, and starts mailing them throughout the German Empire. And so it just catches on like wildfire. And not only that, but there are, though Luther is the one we look to as sort of like the most bombastic and outspoken voice of the Reformation, there are literally dozens and dozens and dozens of people asking the same questions Luther is asking at all places throughout France, throughout Germany, throughout Switzerland, and throughout Italy and the Roman Empire. So all of this is sort of happening at once. And what happens is, because of the printing press, because of the dissemination of literature, all of this comes to the forefront, and there's obviously a massive crisis of authority within the Roman Catholic Church. The Pope excommunicates Luther, and once the Pope excommunicates Luther, it's sort of game on, because the people around Luther are convinced, yeah, but he's not wrong. He's calling for reform, and you're excommunicating him. That doesn't seem like the right way to go about this. There does seem to be a need for reform, and so you end up with this fledgling movement called the Reformation, and this existing Roman Catholic hierarchy, and those become sort of the two polar opposite forces throughout the 16th century that sort of define the history of Europe and obviously still do to this day. So that background in history helps you understand a little bit why were the conditions ripe for the Reformation to happen. You had the printing press. You had this access to all these ancient documents. You had scholars wanting to do work in ancient documents. You had a lot of scholars ready to ask questions of the Pope and of Roman Catholic hierarchy because of the abuses they saw. All of that comes together and sort of lights the torch of this movement of Reformation that still affects us to this day. Chris, I think you're going to give us some more of the political intrigue in a moment, but one thing I like to emphasize is that the Reformation was really an argument about history. Luther and Calvin and Zwingli and the other reformers were not seeking to start a splinter movement. They were not seeking to split the church. They were appealing to the church fathers and saying what the church in the early centuries said and what the church is saying now are different. And so there was a great appeal to history, which I think is important in my conversations with Roman Catholics, because what Roman Catholics usually want to do is they want to claim all of church history as theirs and say, well, the Church of Rome has always taught this and believed this. That's just factually not true. The reformers were saying, hey, if you go back and read the church fathers, read Tertullian, read Origen, read John of Damascus, read Athanasius, read Augustine, these church fathers say what we're saying about the gospel and about justification. And so it really was an argument about history. And the call during the time of the Reformation was, hey, the church in recent centuries has moved away from its history. We need to bring it back. And what the Catholic Counter-Reformation did was basically just to drive a wedge between the Protestant and Catholic traditions so that there was no hope left of reforming the church. The only hope was, hope isn't really even the right word for it. The only way forward was for there to end up being two traditions, Protestant and Catholic. But it really was an argument about history. And if you read Luther, if you read Calvin, they copiously quote from the church fathers and basically say, hey, Mr. Pope, you're not in line with what Augustine said, with what Gregory the Great said, with what these early figures in church history said. The church has steered off the path, and we need to bring it back to orthodoxy.
Another important piece of the background of the Reformation and why the Reformation actually took hold when, as you mentioned, Bob, in previous generations, when someone wanted to bring church reform, it was often smashed. Think of like 100 years before Luther, you had a guy named John Huss, who is from what is now the Czech Republic, who had many of the same beefs as Luther. But he was ultimately, his Reformation was put down rather violently. He was burned at the stake. And so what kept that from happening? Why was the Catholic Church unable to put down Luther's Reformation? A lot of that had to do with the politics of the day too. And so to try to, maybe at the risk of oversimplifying here, give just a little bit of an idea of what was happening politically. So within Europe, you had individual European nations led by their own individual rulers, but all of Europe, or most of Europe, was under what was known as the Holy Roman Empire. So this was kind of the remnant, in some ways, of the old Roman Empire, and so there was some religious aspects to this as well, but you kind of had this overlapping empire. And at the time of the Reformation, you had Charles, who was the Holy Roman Emperor. And this empire was facing several sort of challenges. One, as you mentioned, the Turks. So you had the Turks from the east coming in and invading. And so that was a particular distraction, a particular challenge that they had to put a lot of energy towards. But then also, Charles himself, when he becomes the emperor, isn't a particularly strong leader out of the gate. And so even within the empire, you had those that were sort of challenging his authority. The nation states, for lack of a better term, were sort of asserting their own authority and kind of flexing their own muscle and trying to say, hey, we have the ability to make our own decisions, kind of govern outside of this overarching rule of both the Holy Roman Empire and the Catholic Church. So when Luther comes along, for the German nation to have this reformer, not all the princes and all the leaders in the nation were immediately drawn to Luther and like on his cause, but eventually they saw this as an opportunity to assert their own authority. And so for many of the places where you see the Reformation take hold, that particular government actually began to protect the reformers. And so the reason Luther wasn't martyred or wasn't burned at the stake is because he actually got the protection of the German government. And so this was another important piece, that if this had not been in place, Luther might have been executed and other reformers might have been executed. And just the spread of his works. I mean, the church tried to burn all of his writings and put it down, but these individual governments were able to prop up and protect. And so this is a point that James Davison Hunter makes in his book to Change the World, that one of the key things to sort of changing culture is that there has to be sort of these ripe conditions politically too. And so as much as, you know, the religious and the philosophical and sort of the printing press, all those things were there, without this important political piece, it might have all fallen apart.
Then you have the English monarchs as well that play into the story a little bit later in the 1500s, where you had, I don't know my English history as well, Chris, so you're going to have to correct me here, but you have King Henry VIII, right, who wants to annul his marriage. The Pope won't do it, so he officially breaks from the Roman Catholic Church and creates the Church of England so that he can get divorced.
Yeah.
Then his son takes the throne. His son's kind of a weak ruler. Then you have Bloody Mary. She takes the throne and returns England to Catholic rule, which, of course, riles everybody up because they're sort of happy about being independent for political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Elizabeth take the throne, and she turns back in a hardcore Protestant direction. So you have, within the English culture over the course of about 20 years, you have a dramatic transformation of breaking free from Roman Catholic rule and then trying to reestablish who are we, what is the Church of England going to be. And so you have a reforming type influence in England and Scotland as well, that sort of connects to all that's going on the continent. Is that a fair history?
Yeah, because it's interesting that the Reformation in England was less theological and more political. It was driven initially politically, but then you had some of the leaders who were influenced by Luther within the Church of England. Then you had John Knox going to Geneva, learning from Calvin, bringing that back to Scotland. And so even the Reformation in Scotland, the Reformation in England, just kind of different directions it took, which sort of laid the groundwork for the Puritans in the future and all of that. So, fascinating history.
If you want to think about sort of the front end and back end of the Reformation, front end is 1517. That's usually the date everybody uses as the beginning, because that's when Luther sort of got everything started. By the mid-1520s, this thing is in full force. You have Reformation happening all throughout Europe. The end date is generally 1564 or so. I think that's the year Calvin died, if my dates are right, 1564. And also, it's the Council of Trent. Council of Trent went 1555 to 1563, if my memory serves me correct. And the Council of Trent was sort of the Roman Catholic Church, what would you say? They're nailing the coffin in the Reformation by saying, oh, you guys want to be reformers? We'll show you. And so they sort of like firmly establish that they are not going to be listening to any of the reformers' advice, or they're not going to be changing their view on certain things, especially on indulgences, on purgatory, on some of these doctrines that the reformers were calling for change on. And so the Council of Trent is sort of this hard countermeasure taken by the Roman Catholic Church to sort of decisively say, and the reason I say it's a hard countermeasure is the Council of Trent said, for instance, if anyone believes in justification by faith, let him be anathema. In other words, you're excommunicated from the Roman Catholic Church. You can no longer receive communion or be a member in good standing if you hold to justification by faith. So at the Council of Trent, the only recourse left to those who are crying for reform is to say, well, I guess we're our own thing now, because the Catholic Church has excommunicated us. There's no hope of us reconciling that. And so sort of the Protestant community, which isn't really a community, it's Lutherans and Zwinglians and Calvinists, and there's multiple different communities of these people who are caught up in the Reformation moment. They're sort of left to define their own traditions and establish their own communions. And so that's what you end up having is the Lutheran Church and the Anglican Church and the Reformed churches in Holland and in France and in Geneva, and the Anabaptists and these various traditions sort of have to come together and define what their communion is going to look like based on the Council of Trent saying you're no longer welcome here.
Yeah, and an interesting point to that, there was a time when earlier on when Luther and Zwingli get together to try to unite their movements and cannot come to an agreement based on the issue of the Lord's Supper.
Yeah.
Where Luther had a different take than the Catholic Church, but was a little closer to them on the spectrum, where arguing about how Christ is present, and Luther's view was still just a little too Roman Catholic for Zwingli's taste, and Luther felt like Zwingli
also,
was...
Yeah, Luther was a little obnoxious yes. in his the stories of the Marburg Colloquy, which is the gathering you're talking about. The history is that Luther basically just walked around the room saying over and over again in Latin, "This is my body." Yeah. Like he's not a very easy person to work with.
And doesn't he like pull out a knife one time and start like carving on the table? Yeah. Like, I mean, yeah, he was.
He's not a very Irenic personality.
Right, right. And I can't remember where I read this one time, but someone once made the assertion or kind of the hypothesis that if Calvin had been in the room, because Calvin sort of occupied an in-between space about the presence of the Lord, that he might have been able to kind of mediate that potentially. I don't know. Calvin might have been a little bit stronger personality than Zwingli. I don't know. Maybe he could have tamed Luther a little. I don't know. But it is interesting that how these different communions eventually did kind of diverge and go different ways, even though there was significant agreement in many ways. Other than the Anabaptists just wanted, they were like, you all aren't going far enough. And so they took it to even further extremes. But sort of the main thread, like largely the Lutheran and then the Reformed that came out of the continents of Europe, weren't able to quite come together to the degree where it was all one united Reformation. And so it did end up kind of splintering off and kind of based on geography.
There are two ways to look at the history of the Reformation. I think there's a cynical way to look at it that sees the politics of it and sees the sort of disagreements of it and just says, well, this is just more proof that people are just going to sort of do their own thing and they can't get along and everybody's out for his own good. And, you know, there's a sort of a cynical reading of the Reformation. Obviously, because we believe in human sinfulness, there's some truth in that. There's certainly... no one would look at the period of the Reformation and say, gosh, everything that happened there was glorifying to God. A lot of it was just messy. However, the other reading of the Reformation is to say and to see that it really is a question of history and truth, right? And so I want to say to people listening to this podcast, my longing is always for people to be unapologetically and unashamedly Protestant and to realize... if you go back to the roots of what did the Reformation start over? What were the issues of indulgences, of papal authority, of those pressing questions that Luther was putting forward? Those really are important questions. What justification is a really important question. Who has the authority to forgive sins is a really important question. Where does grace come from? Does it come directly from God or is it mediated by the church through the sacraments? That's a really important question. And to this day, I think the Protestant answer to those questions is correct and the Catholic answer is wrong. It would have been nice to see during the Reformation the ability, not just in the Protestant community, but church-wide, to create dialogue where those things could have been hashed out in a way that wouldn't fracture the communion of the church. However, again, for those who would read history and say, well, this is the 16th century is when all those dang Protestants broke away from the church and started their own thing. That's an unfair reading of history. I would say the 16th century is when some very faithful Catholics sought to bring forward in the Catholic Church a proposal for reform and were excommunicated. And that is that's, I think, a fairer reading of the history of what happened. And all of us, regardless of sort of our theological persuasion or our convictions need to understand that history so that we can understand how we got to where we are. How do we get to a world where there are these three traditions, Eastern Orthodox, Roman Catholic, and Protestant? How do we get to a world within the Protestant tradition where there's sort of multiple streams in that tradition? And, so understanding the history here, I think, is crucial, but also having convictions about, did these arguments matter? Yeah, I think they mattered. I'm glad they had them. I wish they would have resolved themselves a little differently. But where I stand in the stream downstream in the 21st century is to say, yeah, I stand in the stream I do because I come to the same conclusions Luther and Calvin did about the arguments they were having back then. And those arguments matter.
Another thing that I think is important to raise when we think about church history, especially as we think of being on this side of the Reformation, is what do we do with history before the Reformation? Like, what do we do with that period where the Roman Catholic Church was the church for all those centuries? And Doug Wilson makes a great point in his book, which I would recommend, called "Papa Don't Pope."
Good book. Good title.
Just
good
a
book.
Great title. Yes, you will laugh as much as you will learn. But he makes this great point, distinguishing between those who the Reformation versus those who have basically just completely broken away from this stream of church history. And he describes it this way. There are those who sort of ask the question, where was the church before the Reformation? And some of those are going to answer that the idea that the true church sort of disappeared for a time in history. So you start, after the time of the apostles, and eventually things just kind of got more and more corrupt. And then the true church of Jesus just sort of disappeared and everybody is teaching false doctrine. And then later on down the road, somebody discovers, the true teaching of the church, and
the church is
back. Yeah, yeah. So you have, oddly enough, this is the claim of the Mormon church. But you have others that will make this claim that are a little bit more within orthodoxy. But the other is to see, okay, the true church of Jesus never disappeared. And the way Doug Wilson puts it, he goes, if someone were to ask, hey, where was the church before the Reformation? He would say, well, where was your face before you cleaned it off? Same place. The issue isn't that the church disappeared. It's that it needed to be cleaned. It needed to be reformed. And so, understanding that this is, even though we're not Roman Catholic, that is still our history, that we're still a part of that in the church through the centuries, and recognizing that, yeah, Luther... He repeatedly said, I'm not trying to break from this church. I'm a loyal servant of the church, but this needs to be reformed. And so for us as Protestants, we don't need to make these claims and think, okay, well, the true church disappeared and then, Luther and the other reformers,
recovered
it. It's like, no, this is still our history. We still are a part of this, big, messy history of the church. It's just that along the way, there was some losing the gospel in some ways, and some of the practices that came in were not following Scripture. But thankfully, the Lord, as He promised, has cared for His church and has brought reform and renewal, and He's continuing to build His church. And so we don't have to pretend that this isn't our history or make these hard and fast breaks. We can still own this and embrace this and learn from it. And so as a Protestant, I would... and as a pastor, I would encourage anyone else who's a Protestant to sort of say, yeah, this is part of my history, and that's okay.
Well, hopefully for our listeners, this helps you understand some of the history and background, and also helps you embrace your heritage, embrace your the conviction of being unapologetically Protestant and Reformed. And even if you're not a Protestant listener, maybe you're Catholic or Eastern Orthodox, hopefully this helps you understand a little more the nuance and the complexity of the Reformation and the tradition that we on around this table find ourselves standing in.
That's going to do it for this week's conversation. Our goal for this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or church leader in another context, we thank you for listening in, and we pray that the things that we've talked about might also be helpful to you as you minister in your own context. Shoot us your topic ideas, podcast@cdomaha.com, and leave us a nice 5-star review on iTunes. And we'll talk to you again next week for another Wednesday conversation.